From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd, and today for Jeremy Hobson, it's Here and Now. President-elect Donald Trump has chosen his former campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, to be counselor to the president once he's sworn in. And this morning, Conway was busy clarifying Trump's stance on a proposal to temporarily ban Muslims from entering the country. Here she is on ABC's Good Morning America.
He said during the campaign, long after he had originally proposed that, that this would be more strictly tied to countries where we know they have a history of terrorism, and that this is not a complete ban.
Now, Conway was addressing the issue because of Trump's answer to a reporter's question yesterday about his proposed registry for Muslims and the ban of Muslim immigrants after Monday's attack in Berlin. Trump told reporters, quote, "You know my plans." Joining us now is NPR's Scott Horsley. And Scott, when Trump says, "You know my plans," some people might say, well, no, we don't really. So where do we stand on that?
This was a sort of seemingly direct but rather vague answer that we've been getting from the president-elect. Let's go back. It was about a year ago that the then-candidate Donald Trump first proposed what he called a total ban on Muslims coming into the United States. That was in the wake of the terror attacks both in Paris and in San Bernardino, California. Over the course of the campaign, that sort of subtly morphed, although it was never really made explicit, but it subtly morphed into what the campaign referred to as extreme vetting. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump said yesterday that whatever his policy is has been proven correct by the terror attacks this week. Now, he was also asked about the idea of a registry for Muslims living in the United States. He didn't, again, directly respond to that question except to say that, "You know my plans." We do know that today the Obama administration is taking steps to withdraw the regulations from what had been a pre-existing Muslim registry. This was something that was put in place during the George W. Bush administration and then lapsed back in about 2011. It was deemed to be costly and inefficient and didn't actually do anything to make us safer. But the regulatory framework for that system remained in place. And there was some thought in the advocacy community that even though the program was long dormant, the regulations could have given the Trump administration something of a head start if, in fact, the administration wants to start a Muslim registry. So by withdrawing it, it sort of takes that potential head start away. The transition team was asked about that this morning, but they didn't really have any kind of answer for us.
So the debate on that issue obviously is still going on. Well, let's talk about this new role for Kellyanne Conway. She has said before that she was skeptical of taking a high-profile position in the White House because she has young children. But here she is on Fox this morning.
I know this will be a very family-friendly West Wing and White House. I've seen the president-elect with his own children and grandchildren. I know many of his female employees over a number of decades and years at the Trump Corporation. So I'm fine on that score. And I think that when you have this opportunity,
We know Donald Trump likes to reward loyalty. What will Conway be doing in the White House?
I think her role will be similar to what she did on the campaign. She was the third and final manager of the Trump campaign.
At the most important time.
Obviously successful there. She was thought to have brought some discipline both to the messaging of the campaign and maybe to the candidate himself. She'll presumably play a similar role in the West Wing at the White House. There was some thought that she might be named press secretary for the administration because she's been a frequent spokesperson for the campaign and the transition on television. But I think having those kids was something that would have made the press secretary's job difficult. This role will be more flexible but potentially more powerful. She'll be serving along with Chief of Staff Reince Priebus and strategist Steve Bannon. And she said this morning she has the president-elect's trust and his ear.
Well, we have another name as well in the administration today. Peter Navarro, Trump says, will lead a new White House office to oversee American trade and industrial policy. Now, he's an interesting choice because here's a clip of a documentary that Navarro wrote. It's called Death by China.
China's military power is strengthening very, very rapidly.
It's developing a modern, well-equipped, technologically capable military.
China is the only major nation in the world that is preparing to kill Americans.
Okay, strong language, Scott, but just quickly, what does this say about, again, it seems like Trump is sort of reasserting his position on China here.
Peter Navarro has long been a tough critic of China from an economic standpoint, and he was an economic advisor to Donald Trump throughout the campaign. He worked along with the nominee for Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross to craft Trump's novel infrastructure plan. So Peter Navarro will have an ongoing role in the White House and presumably continue to help shape economic policy for the incoming administration.
Okay. NPR's White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
Good to be with you.
President-elect Trump has promised to rescind President Obama's executive orders on immigration, including those granting temporary protection from deportation to some students in the country illegally. That has some colleges and universities worried that their students without legal resident status could find themselves essentially locked out of the country if they don't return from study abroad trips by January 20th, the day Trump takes the oath of office. Fred Tice of contributing station WBUR explains.
Daishi Tanaka arrived in Los Angeles from Japan with his parents 13 years ago when he was six.
I walked into my first grade classroom and I saw the diversity. Everyone's of all shapes, colors, sizes, personalities meld into one, you know, under the flag, and that I love.
But while Tanaka felt he melded with other Americans under the flag, officially his adopted country had marked him as not belonging until President Obama intervened. Tanaka is a sophomore at Harvard now. He is among the hundreds of thousands of young people granted temporary protected status because their parents brought them illegally to the U.S. as children, and they grew up in this country. In Massachusetts, universities are quietly counseling students to make sure they're back in the U.S. by January 20th, the day Trump is to be inaugurated. California's public universities, in contrast, have taken the lead in issuing public warnings. Cal State is telling students who have temporary relief from deportation and are studying abroad to return to the United States before the inauguration of Trump. The University of California is advising students who received reprieves from deportation, called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival, or DACA, to be aware of the risks of being out of the country with Trump expected to become president next month. Tanaka recalls the extreme hardships his parents suffered as people who lived in the U.S. without legal documents.
When I went back home to California, they were living in a garage because they were taking care of the elderly, and they were extremely underpaid. They were really mistreated and manipulated by their employer, and all because they don't have the formal rights and the formal legal protection. My dad used to work for a Trump supporter. It's ironic.
Last summer, Tanaka's parents returned to the Philippines and Japan, where they're from.
I have been planning to go to Japan this winter to see my parents. There seemed to be a sentiment that I should be back before January 20th.
The decisions about whether to risk travel abroad come amid a wider worry that even if they are in the United States, the students could be deported. At Boston University Law School, Associate Professor Leila Hlas directs the Immigrants' Rights Clinic.
Trump has said that he's going to take away their status. He's going to take away all the executive orders under President Obama. So it's very likely that the DACA students may be undocumented yet again. And now the immigration agency has all of their information. And so they could easily be put onto a deportation list. And they could be prioritized if that's what this administration wants to do.
But, Hlas says, her general advice to DACA students is to wait and see and to stay in touch. She also tells DACA students they may have other options to stay in the United States.
A lot of students came to these clinics to try to get DACA, and people realized they're actually eligible for a pathway to a green card and to citizenship.
Hlas says some could be eligible as immigrant juveniles or because they're the children of women who have been assaulted.
Some of them may have other relatives who could petition for them through a family visa. Some of them are survivors of serious crimes.
At Boston College Law School, Associate Professor Mary Holper is director of the Immigration Clinic. She is organizing efforts to reach out to DACA students and students who've yet to apply for DACA.
If you haven't applied yet, it's pretty risky to apply because you could be putting yourself on the list for deportation. You have to put your addresses on the application. You could be putting at risk anybody in your family.
That said, Holper points out that Republican U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina is proposing legislation that would protect DACA recipients. Holper says students who already have DACA but must renew are risking very little.
Because they already know about you. So if to the extent that Trump is going to use this, I hope he won't, as a list for deportation, you're already on it. So to me, that risk seems very low.
Still, with Trump's inauguration approaching, Holper says DACA students who are currently out of the United States for study abroad or other reasons should heed this warning.
I would say come home before, because the advance parole that they were given, it's still highly discretionary. Every single time you come back in the border, you are facing the individual discretion of the officer that lets you in at the airport, and that officer is going to have a different boss with different priorities come January, and so I would say come home.
Come home to the United States by January 20th, or you may be locked out. That's what colleges are advising their students who grew up in this country but are here without the right documents. For Here and Now, I'm Fred Tice.
The UN voted yesterday to investigate possible war crimes in Syria's nearly six-year civil war. Russia, Syria's main ally, voted against it. And yesterday, author John McHugo told us why the connection between Russia and Syria has become so strong over the years.
I'm afraid this was because of a major mistake that the West made. In the 1950s, it was the era of the Cold War. It was also, of course, when the Arab-Israeli conflict was at its height. And basically, the Western powers abandoned Syria. Syria needed arms for its defense. The Western powers refused to sell them.
So Russia stepped in and an alliance was born. Well, today we're taking a look at two men who have ruled Syria for more than 45 years, the late Hafez al-Assad and his son Bashar. David Lesh is a distinguished professor of history at Trinity University. He met regularly with the Syrian president between 2004 and 2009. David, welcome. And you're one of the few Westerners who knows Bashar al-Assad. Are you at all surprised by what's happening in his country?
No, I wasn't shocked when he initiated the harsh crackdown of the protesters early in the uprising in spring 2011, because you know, over the years, I began to see this evolution in him, this assimilation into the authoritarian structure over which he presided. From the unpretentious, unassuming, self-deprecating person that I met early on in his tenure in power, he had begun to change into someone who, surrounded by sycophants, started to see the world through this particular prism that's based in Damascus. You know, again, rather than changing the system that many of us hoped he would do when he came to power, and many Syrians as well, the system changed him.
What was he like personally on a one-on-one basis?
Oh, he was very agreeable. One time I asked him, can you list your achievements thus far? And he said, I'd rather just probably list my failures because they're much more numerous. Many people I've known, diplomats I've known who have met, classic dictators of late in the Middle East, such as Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, as well as Bashar al-Assad, to a person they all say Bashar al-Assad was different. You know, he was much more normal, so to speak. Whereas the others, you tended to see the eccentricities or thuggishness, it came through. And that's why I think a lot of people, had hope in the beginning that perhaps he would be different from these other ones.
Well, he had a storyline, a backstory that the West could sort of get behind. He spoke English very well. He was an eye doctor. He had this glamorous British wife. They even paid a PR firm to sort of burnish their image. I mean, do you think that led much of the world to underestimate him?
I think we overestimated him. I think, in fact, it raised the expectations in the West that he would be someone who would engage in political reform in Syria, who would improve relations with Israel and with the West, because he liked the technological toys of the West, because he liked Western music, because he was an ophthalmologist who studied 18 months in London. He's a likable person, and I'm not a psychologist, but that's maybe the saddest thing about this is here was this fairly normal, likable person, and he turns into a new Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi, certainly in the perception of the West. But what most people forget is that, he's a child of the Arab-Israeli war. He's a child of the superpower Cold War, where his country was on the side of the Soviet Union He's a child of the tumult in Lebanon. And most importantly, he's a child of his father, Hafez al-Assad.
Yeah, let's talk about him. Because Hafez al-Assad died in 2000. And the father led the Ba'ath Party, which, just a little background, promoted a secular Arab state inside Syria. The father rose to power in a coup in 1970. What else can you tell us about the father that might help us understand the son?
Well, in fact, Bashar is very much more like his father than the sort of anointed would-be king, Bashar's brother, who died in a car accident in 1994. It was much more flamboyant. I mean, the father was very much of an intellectual, you know, sort of kept to himself and kept out of the spotlight a little bit. And Bashar, although he's engaged in much more public diplomacy than his father ever did, is much more like that in temperament and style. But, you know, I have this thought, I have no evidence for this, but, you know, during the uprising, I kind of have this feeling that at some point, Bashar just had, you know, this moment where he said, you know, my father was right. He knew how to handle this situation like this. And I'm referring, of course, to 1982 when there was a Muslim Brotherhood uprising against his father's regime, and he brutally put down the uprising, the epicenter of it in Hama, with anywhere, you know, around 20 to 30,000 people being killed, and not a peep was heard for a while after that.
And that's, you know, the moment when the father cements his reputation as being the brutal dictator that we know him as today.
Right, yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think a lot of people that were around him at the time made it into Bashar's inner circle in the beginning. And that's kind of the, you know, the modus operandi that defined how the regime under the father, and obviously under the son now, deals with protest and uprising.
What did people expect from Bashar al-Assad when he came to power in 2000?
Well, you know, my first meeting with him in 2004, after the pleasantries and after I told him what I was going to be doing in interviewing him, you know, I said, you know, Mr. President, the biggest mistake you made upon coming to power is that you said you liked Phil Collins' music, the British rock star. And he kind of looked at me. But what it did is it fed into this emerging image in the West that, you know, he was pro-Western, he was pro-reform, you know, and would do all of these things that the West had wanted, you know, Syria to do for all of these years. But those were misplaced expectations.
Early on, he decided to free or release hundreds of political prisoners that were jailed under his father's regime. But as you say, that didn't last, this sense of reform.
No, and I think there are some who disagree with me on this, but I think he really did intend on trying to engage in more reform than perhaps the system could take. There was private newspapers, unprecedented amount of criticism allowed, private salons opened up and private forums. And basically, after about 6 to 8 months of this sort of thing, some of the regime tough guys, came to him and said, young man, you can't do this sort of thing. It's going to undermine the foundation of the regime.
Well, a modern history, I think, is where most people will pick up the story of Bashar al-Assad. Spring of 2011, the Arab Spring was raging across the Middle East. Assad is cracking down on protesters, and outside pressure begins to mount on him. And late that year, Barbara Walters goes to Damascus and does a high-profile interview with Assad. Here it is.
Much of the world regards you as a dictator and a tyrant. What do you say to that?
What's important how the Syrian people look at you, not how you look at yourself. Anyone could have his own opinion, whether president or official or any citizen, the same for me, outside our border.
Public opinion doesn't matter.
Outside Syria?
Outside Syria.
No.
In the context of today, David Lesh, what do you make of those statements from the president?
I think it fits rather perfectly in how Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian regime looks at the rest of the world, you know, that it's been threatening Syria for all these years, long before 2011, going back to the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri in 2005, where Syria was blamed for it and isolated. And so this, to them, was just a continuation of an attack against Syria and attempts to try to undermine the regime. Ever since that time. So to them, it was sort of unsurprising in that the Arab Spring that was occurring elsewhere was just an excuse to try to foment trouble inside of Syria without really understanding that, you know, there were, you know, domestic problems and a true indigenous uprising against the the failures and frailties of the regime.
But you make this point, this fascinating point, that it could have gone differently, because in March of 2011, Assad made a speech to the country in which he decided to take a defiant approach to the protesters by essentially saying they were supported by terrorists. This speech paves the way for some of the violent methods that Assad will eventually use to crack down on these protesters. And you've written that this was a crossroads because Assad almost made a different speech at the time that would have been much more conciliatory. What happened?
Well, according to my research, and I knew I know a number of insiders who were very close to him regarding the speech that he made on March 30th, 2011, his first to, you know, publicly to address the uprising. And there were different drafts. And one person I know who was close to him and a friend of his thought that a more conciliatory draft was the one that was going to be the speech he was going to give in front of the Syrian parliament. And he was shocked when he was, you know, seeing it on TV that it was the more harsh one. Mm. And so, you know, one wonders what happened. And you know, speculation is that some in the security apparatus that were close to him basically convinced him that, look, we can put this down in 3 or 4 weeks. You know, you don't want to seem soft. And obviously that was a mistake.
And of course, it led to this terrible civil war that is still going on. The West, as we know, accuses him of using chemical weapons and barrel bombs in that fight, which have killed hundreds, maybe thousands of civilians. The country, David, is essentially in ruins. How does the Bashar al-Assad story end?
Well, I think it ends with him staying in power for the foreseeable future, certainly through the end of his current term in 2021. What will happen then, I don't know. And that's why I would love to meet with him again, because war can change someone. And especially if he survives this, and his sense of triumphalism after this will make him even, you know, more secure and more determined to stay in power.
David Lesh, Distinguished Professor of History at Trinity University and author of Fall of the House of Assad. David, thanks very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
Oklahoma football coach Bob Stoops made his first public comments yesterday about a graphic video that shows star running back Joe Mixon punching a woman in the face at a restaurant in 2014. The woman's head strikes a table as she falls to the floor. Mixon was charged with a misdemeanor but agreed to a plea and received 1 year of probation and community service. Oklahoma suspended him for the 2015 season, but he was allowed to return this year. And yesterday, Stoops defended the suspension, but then said this.
2.5 years later, it's fair to say it isn't enough. And that's positive in that that's the way the things have gone in the last 2.5 years, that really the only thing that's ever acceptable anymore is dismissal.
Mike Pesca is Here and Now's sports analyst. He hosts the podcast The Gist at Slate.com. And Mike, the video was just made public, which is why Stoops is talking about it this week. But let's just be clear about what it is that he's actually saying. Is he taking responsibility for the school's response, or isn't he?
Great question. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if Stoops knows the answer to that. He's using words like responsibility. I think that some of his statements can be read as, well, the world we live in has evolved to a place where suspension is the right punishment for this. So maybe he's saying, so don't judge me based on our 2014 mores, so far removed as they are from 2016. But, you know, Mixon will be playing unless something changes. He'll be playing in Oklahoma's bowl game. He'll be playing in the Sugar Bowl. So there you have the coach saying, well, if it was today, I would have suspended him or dismissed him. But it is today. Like, today is today, and January 2nd will be the days to play in the bowl game.
But so he's not backing it up.
He's still scheduled to play.
Essentially, he's not backing it up.
I think he's saying, you know, maybe he could, maybe he's essentially, although he didn't articulate this, maybe he's saying something along the lines of, he's serve the penalty that he was sentenced to. But today, I think the sentence would be harsher. But since he is the judge, jury, and executioner in this case, he could make the sentence harsher if he was so moved by his convictions. It should also be said the tape was made public only because the Oklahoma broadcasters sued. So the police didn't want to make it public. And that went to the Oklahoma court. And it was to be made public now. So now that everyone is seeing the tape, that's why the coach is talking about it. But the coach saw the tape 2 years ago when he made the decision to suspend for only a year.
Well, look,
so it's a morass.
Yeah, you know, Mixon is also very good. He could very easily go to the NFL. But the question probably is, will anybody take him? Because we know the NFL has been dogged by this issue of its players being violent to women. I mean, what is his future in the NFL if he's got one?
I think that's not a question, or that's a question where the clear answer is yes, because he's very, very good. He's one of the – he could be a first-round pick, even early first-round pick. Such are his skills as a running back, and he's just an offensive weapon, catches balls out of the backfield. Now, Tyreek Hill at Oklahoma State, not Oklahoma, he abused his then-pregnant girlfriend. And he was dismissed by Oklahoma State when he played there, but he was drafted by the Kansas City Chiefs in the fifth round, and there are those who say that but for the suspension, he would have been drafted higher. Well, he's excellent. He's a great player. In fact, the NFL put him on its Twitter feed. He was so good in a week, and it got a little blowback. But the lesson is that every professional athlete gets second and possibly third chances based on how good you are. There's a justification to that, like we don't live in a one strike and you're out society, and yet being good seems to override being moral.
Yeah. Here and now, sports analyst Mike Pesca, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yesterday, we told you about the family held hostage in Afghanistan, American Caitlin Coleman, her Canadian husband, Joshua Boyle, and their two little boys born in captivity. Kate and Josh, as their families call them, were kidnapped on a backpacking trip in 2012. She was 5 months pregnant. Josh delivered their second child by flashlight. On Monday, the Taliban-linked Haqqani Network released a video of them. Here, Caitlin talks about their captors as Josh, in leg chains, soothes the children.
They want money, power, friends. You must give them these things before progress can be made. A 5-year hostage taking is too long and indicates failure on every side.
That video is the first Caitlin and Josh's parents have seen of their grandchildren. Her parents in Pennsylvania are not commenting. Josh's parents, Patrick and Linda Boyle, don't often speak publicly, but they are here by Skype. Patrick and Linda, are you there?
Yes, we are.
Thank you for your interest in the story.
Well, of course we are. And tell us more. Why? Why do you feel it's important to speak now? Patrick, why don't you start?
Well, I guess it's the two recent videos, especially Monday's. Amazing pictures, unbelievable messaging.
Well, let's start with the pictures first. Linda, what did you feel when you saw your grandchildren for the first time?
Oh, my gosh. I loved seeing them, you know, the older boys, seeing they're making faces. And I've got a picture in front of me now of my our second youngest daughter, and they could pass as twins. They're identical, even the haircuts, which they used to laugh at. I only knew one haircut for all the kids. But it was good to see them. And I think it speaks to, you know, Josh and Kate's parents, like, in spite of everything, they're managing to still be children.
Yeah. Well, in fact, you've been in communication with Josh and Kate, and you told a reporter who's become a friend of the family, who told us that, in fact, they are treating this like a movie. They're telling their children that this is a game.
Well, I guess that's one of the saddest parts of the letter was when he said they're playing the game. It's a beautiful life. So pretending that this isn't real for them, and it's just part of a game. And I can't imagine what it's like, but you have to assume that's what you do to get through.
This is what Josh wrote you. This is the film Life is Beautiful, and the father in the film pretends for his son that they're not really in a concentration camp, you know, just devastating. So what more immediacy do you think there is here, Patrick? Some have said that this tape might be related to the fact that the son of the founder of the Haqqani Network was just indicted in a court. I mean, what do you think is going on?
A couple of things on a very practical and hopeful level. Obviously, a proof of life of all four of them was needed to get this just moving forward towards a resolution. The captors, the Taliban, have chosen the timing to release this. So in their minds, now is the time to act. So we are trying to be responsive. We are trying to encourage all levels of government to be responsive. So it's a good message, we hope, from timing. We think it's hopeful. From the Afghan captors, the Haqqani network, the Taliban, the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, this is tied to a couple of things very much. It seems clear in the last two videos and the timing of both, that it's tied to the trial of Anas Haqqani and another Haqqani network member, which is before the Afghan courts now. And they've also made it clear that it's about the transition in the U.S. before the inauguration. They make Kate talk about Jimmy Carter and the Iran hostages.
Yeah, the fact that Jimmy Carter failed to get the hostages back during his tenure as president. He did, but, you know, as Ronald Reagan was taking office. What do you want to happen? I mean, you know that governments are loath to trade hostages for terrorists. That, you know, that then you'll have more hostages.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because certainly if you asked me this 5 years ago, my attitude was totally different. And I just certainly bought into that. Not that I agree, you know, with the, oh, yes, just go ahead, do whatever they ask. But at the same time, you know, it's the idea of, oh, there'll be more hostages just doesn't work. This is a weapon of war. They take hostages when they feel they're at war. It's been going on for thousands of years. It's that simple.
Well, and they don't let them go, and they don't kill them right away if they're from a country like Canada or the United States. Clearly, the captors don't believe that governments can't do anything.
Look, you mentioned, Patrick, that you want to keep this in the news. You want to keep this on top of people's minds. First of all, what's that been like to be? We've spoken to other parents whose adult children have been taken hostage. It's horrendous because you don't know what to do. If you talk, you might jeopardize them. But if you don't talk, people forget. What's that like? And also, why don't you think this has captured more imaginations, especially after that video on Monday?
I think it makes people uncomfortable, and some people just don't like to be uncomfortable, and it's easy enough to turn away if you're not living it. So that's part of it. I think for a lot of people, I just call it a arrogant, judgmental attitude that I would never do that, so therefore it must be wrong. But, you know, where would the world be at this time if nobody ever went beyond their own personal space?
Well, let's be clear, when they say who would do that, they're talking about, you know, the early criticism of who backpacks in Afghanistan when you're 5 months pregnant. And there was also not just criticism, but suspicion, especially since Josh, your son, was married years ago to the sister of Omar Khadr, who'd been held at Guantanamo and is serving a sentence in Canada. He was involved in one of the first deaths of an American soldier in Afghanistan in that war that began so many years ago.
You've raised a couple of very fair questions. The Khadr question, Joshua's brief first marriage. Fair question comes to everybody's mind right away upon hearing this. What we know is the U.S. and the Canadian government fully investigated this at the outset, and the FBI years ago publicly said this was a horrible coincidence.
Right.
So it's not what this is about. Then there's the circumstances of capture, people thinking, I wouldn't do that. Why would somebody do that? But stop and think. People swim beyond their abilities, and we go out and save them, and people take steps. Skiers ski out of bounds. When something goes wrong, adventuresome people get rescued. They weren't stupid, and they didn't deserve this. Nobody does. They were adventuresome, but they were responsible. They went there legally. They contacted tourist operators and accommodations beforehand. They communicated regularly with family and friends, and they had return tickets for early December, a couple of months before her due date.
Look, Patrick and Linda Boyle, we certainly don't feel that you have to defend your children, and now there are grandchildren. How do you get up in the morning? How do you, it's been years. How do you do this?
You don't really have a choice. Life goes on and you make the best of it. And that's what we're handed in life. We all have to deal with what we're handed with, and that's what we were handed with. So we deal with it best we can.
Yeah.
Yep, it's really a two-step program, get up in the morning, pray that we get them back today, or that today passes quickly and we do well.
Yeah.
Look, you're hoping that your speaking reaches the right ears. What do you want to say and to who?
Well, I'm not sure, you know, where it's going to reach, but certainly if Josh and those and Katie and the kids hear it, you know, obviously we want to tell them how much we love them, we miss them. So proud of them both, Josh and Kate, knowing that they're taking care of their families best they can. Keep up the hope. It's the first prayer and the last prayer of every day is to give them strength. And that we're doing all we can, but it's really in the hands of the captors and the governments. They don't want to talk to us.
If the captors are listening, we want to assure them that the families have taken the messages seriously and have pursued it most diligently with governments. Message received loud and clear and being acted upon. If it's Josh and Kate, I echo Linda's love to all four of them and pride in seeing Josh and Katie get their kids through this far so well. Elated to see they're looking healthy after all of this time in the circumstances. And I think it being Christmas, I'd just say to Josh that I can picture him reading Forsyth's Shepherd's Story to the boys from memory at this point.
Yeah. Patrick and Linda Boyle, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
The cigar box guitar was an invention of poor African-American musicians who took wooden cigar boxes and turned them into instruments during the mid-19th century. Well, recently there's been a renaissance. Hadi Mawagdi of KERA in Dallas spoke with historians, musicians, and makers of cigar box guitars to learn more.
Kevin Edwards cuts into a piece of wood inside his music shop in downtown McKinney, a city north of Dallas. There's an old record player in the corner, and guitars hang on the wall. Edwards uses them to teach lessons. But when he's not teaching, Edwards crafts cigar box guitars.
I like the freehand style, so I do all mine freehanded.
He got the idea a few years back when he saw a busker playing one.
Drawn to it instantly. It was pretty cool being a guitar player myself, so started researching them online and then started building my own and then just kept at it.
Edwards has made and sold more than 100 cigar box guitars. They sell for $150 a pop, a bargain considering that you can find them for as much as $2,000 online. But it's also ironic because at one time, these homemade guitars were a poor man's instrument. Now you can spot stars like Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top, Keith Richards, and a former Beatle playing them.
Paul McCartney won a Grammy for his performance with Dave Grohl's Sound City, and in there, McCartney has the song Give Me Some Slack, and he's playing a cigar box guitar as well.
That's the self-proclaimed king of the cigar box guitar, Shane Spiel from York, Pennsylvania.
The cigar box guitar has not only become my passion, but it's become my occupation.
Spiel is a musician, historian, and sort of the patron saint of cigar box guitars. He says the cigar box guitar is a variation of a single string instrument called the diddley bow, and both can be traced back to an African instrument called the gimbri.
And the gimbri was nothing but an empty wooden box with a skin over top, but the neck was shoved the whole way through the body of the instrument. Most cigar box guitars are made that way, too.
Spiel says turning cigar boxes into a version of the gimbri began in the mid-1800s and is indirectly connected to the U.S. shipping and tax regulations.
Cigars used to be shipped in big barrels, but the government needed to tax them, so they said that cigars needed to be packaged in boxes of like 20 or 50.
Since cigars were popular at the time, all of a sudden these decorative wooden boxes were everywhere. The instrument soon followed, and so did instructions for creating them.
We've found plans written by Daniel Carter Beard, the man who started the Boy Scouts. He published plans for how to make a cigar box banjo that were based on a banjo that his family's slave made.
By the 1920s, the simple 3- and 4-string instruments were spotted far away from the Deep South, where they originated.
I've also found a pocket of cigar box guitars and other instruments in the Upper Peninsula of Wisconsin and Michigan.
Today, Dallas bluesman Reverend K.M. Williams performs with custom instruments, including a cigar box guitar. He says it's a tradition.
Elmo James used to play a diddly bow. Muddy Waters used to play a diddly bow. Lionel Hopkins built a cigar box guitar out of screen wire. All of these great musicians used to play cigar box or diddly bow related guitars.
And then, says Shane Spiel, there was Blind Willie Johnson.
He learned to play at the age of 5 on a one-string cigar box guitar that his dad made him. And Blind Willie Johnson took an old pocket knife, and he would play up and down that one string with that pocket knife as a slide.
Johnson's 1927 song, Dark Was the Night, Cold Was the Ground, is on the golden record that launched into space in 1977 on the Voyager space probe. That recording was made with a single-string slide guitar. But Spiel says it's the type of song that Johnson grew up learning to play on his cigar box guitar. And what's so special about the cigar box guitar? Spiel says it's the sound. The thing buzzes, it rattles, it's raspy, and it's absolutely perfectly imperfect. Music shop owner Kevin Edwards agrees.
Every single one sounds a little bit different. So like when you string them up at the end after spending so much time building them, it's very exciting to hear what it sounds like.
Who needs to buy a guitar when you can just go and build one? For Here and Now, I'm Hadi Mawagdi.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. For Jeremy Hobson and the Here and Now staff, see you soon. Some of us, somebody, will be here. Here and Now.